High Bridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Jersey Breaks, Becoming an American Poet, by Robert Pinsky. Read by Robert Pinsky. The book is dedicated to Jill Neerham. Gimme a break, folk saying. Sorrow would break the seal stamped over time and set the baskets where the bough is bent. Louise Bogan, Simple Autumnal. But love has pitched his mansion in the place of excrement, for nothing can be soul or whole that has not been rent. William Butler Yeats, Crazy Jane Talks with the Bishop. Prologue. Given my background, a friend asked me, how is it I became a poet rather than a criminal or an optometrist? I could quibble. My father, Milford Pinsky, was an optician, not an optometrist, a common mistake. And it's true that his father, Dave Pinsky, was a criminal. But as my Aunt Thelma used to say, her pop was in the liquor business, and it happened to be during Prohibition. That was the era when Dave, my Zadie Pop, as I called him, pursued the liquor business in our hometown, Long Branch, New Jersey. Trivial and significant, stupid and profound, like a family oppressive and nurturing, like the larger world seductive and treacherous. My feelings about the town are as confused as can be. My bedeviled patriotism, my need for the lofty outcast art of poetry, my C student's distrust of worldly rewards and punishments, the inward voice that spurs me to bring together disparate times, places, and things, that attraction to a mishmash, all began in Long Branch. If I have a story to tell, it's how the failures and aspirations of a certain time and place led to poetry. Chapter 1. A Provincial Sense of Time. At a Library of Congress luncheon in Washington in the year 2000, the speakers included Congressman Frank Pallone of Long Branch, New Jersey. Frank Pallone's family and mine had known one another for three generations. His father, Frank Pallone Sr., was a respected cop of the old-school kind who might catch a 13-year-old shoplifting and lock the kid into a cell for a few hours, then let him go with a lecture. The congressman's mother was a figure in Long Branch town legend. She went to the beach looking great in her leopard-spotted two-piece bathing suit with her two little boys, Frank and his brother, togged out in their matching leopard-spotted trunks. Frank Pallone has said that to understand my poetry, you need to understand our town. I know what he means. The races and ethnicities, with all the other blends, resistances, suspicions, borrowings, intermarriages, rivalries, and molten allies of American cuisine, art, and social life, all concentrated in a seashore resort that was near great cities, yet, by definition, away from them. That was a world the congressman and I had known all our lives. Also at the head table that day was another person I admired. The elegant Lynn Chase had just arrived on a flight from New York to attend this Washington event in her capacity as president of the Academy of American Poets. A beautiful woman in her 70s, Lynn was a sharp-witted patron of the arts, charming and very rich and accustomed to getting her way. Quote, I got off the plane and realized I had no credit cards or money, Lynn said when I greeted her. So I had to pick up a man who would give me a ride to get here. After Representative Pallone finished his remarks at the microphone, Lynn Chase asked me, Is the congressman coming back? No, he headed back to the Hill. Good, I was surprised to hear her say. I hate his brother. I thought of the two little boys in their leopard swimsuits, and also I thought of the recent mayoral campaign in Long Branch. Adam Schneider had been reelected mayor, but Frank Pallone's younger brother, John Pallone, unexpectedly challenged Adam, running a failed campaign against him. The election campaign had gotten a bit rough, as I heard from my aunts and cousins, straining a long friendship between the two families, the Schneiders and the Pallones. There were lots of people in town with those names, exactly the kind of thing the congressman remarked on in my poems. Over dessert and coffee, I tried to explain this Long Branch story at some length. Maybe I even mentioned Marion Pallone's leopard-spotted bathing suit. Meanwhile, the Library of Congress officials at our table and Lynn Chase all listened politely. As I finished talking a little too much, I said how surprised I was that Lynn knew about the congressman's family. How had she come to hate his brother? Lynn responded mildly. What I said was, I ate his butter. I sometimes think with my ears and my voice, putting music above meaning. It's a habit that has been my failing and my calling. Little Silver, Hazlitt, Perth Amboy, Rahway, and Secaucus were stops on the New York and Long Branch Railroad. I don't know much about those places, but the consonants and vowels of their names, chanted by old-school conductors on the way to Penn Station, made a familiar, seductive music. My many aunts and uncles lived in Hoboken, Hackensack, Summit, Passaic, Hopewell, and the Oranges. Which family lived where, I don't remember, but those place names made a verbal harmony, like what I found years later in 16th-century lyrics, poetry by John Dowland and Thomas Campion. My mishearing Lynn's words, I ate his butter, is an example of the provincial sense of time. In a proper understanding of time, you focus on causes and effects over centuries or years or hours. But from a limited, intensely local viewpoint, the centuries and years and hours might be understood through a particular place and its people. That's how I misheard Lynn Chase's plain sentence. Space, in the form of a town and its imagination, preempted the reality of time. In a certain kind of place, everything can feel simultaneous. Somewhere in my imagination, along with a rational sense of history, general and personal, I dwell in a cloudy olden days, where the two little boys with their pretty mother, all three of them in leopard-spotted swimsuits, walked to the beach down a stairway from the bluff being painted by Winslow Homer, crossing the boardwalk in Ocean Avenue where they could buy lunch at Max's Famous Hot Dogs and admire the fast horses of President Grant, who defeated the forces of evil in the Civil War. Grant, a friend of Mark Twain, and a hard-drinking man who might buy his prohibited whiskey from my Zadie Pop, or maybe drink it at Zadie Pop's Broadway Tavern near the Garfield Grant Hotel. Landmarks in an irrational but significant past that may even include the Dawson's Landing of Mark Twain, along with the Dublin of James Joyce, all the terrain, as Congressman Frank Pallone recognized, of my imagination. The blending of different periods in time weaves into the haphazard blending of cultures in a way the congressman understood. I inherited an edgy mix of hierarchies and goofs, tribal alliances and conflicts, ways of surviving and ways of storytelling, local and global. I grew up inculcated with awe of the past, an awe that went beyond any actual, reliable knowledge of the past. A personal landmark, for me, was one of the main junkyards in Long Branch that used to belong to a man named, as if by Charles Dickens, Ash. I went to Izzy Ash's junkyard in the summer of 1962 to buy a used fuel pump for a 1953 Dodge Coronet convertible I wanted to drive to Palo Alto, California. I was going to graduate school at Stanford. Mr. Ash took in that information as he grunted and tugged at a long-handled wrench to loosen the part I needed from a wrecked Coronet. I told Mr. Ash that I was going to graduate school, not that I was going to be a writer or a poet. As it happens, he knew more than you might expect about going to graduate school, and I had already been embarrassed earlier that summer by local people knowing that I was, or that I meant to become, a writer. A Long Branch boy named Danny Pingator was having a little success under another name as a television actor. The absurdity of the ambition that I was carrying west with me seemed clear when Danny phoned me. I didn't really know him. He was at least 5 years older than me, but I knew his brother Anthony. Their mother had run into mine in a store when Danny was in Long Branch for part of July, so he had my phone number. "Robert, this is Danny Pingator. Your mother says you're going out to California to be a writer. And there's something I really need to tell you, Robert. Don't go." "What?" "Don't go, Robert. I mean it. I know a lot of writers in L.A. They all say this is the worst year ever. Nobody is doing hour-long shows anymore. It's all half-hour. Most of the writers already out there can't find work." So I just told Mr. Ash I was going to Stanford to graduate school. In Izzy Ash's class at Long Branch High School, there were two outstanding students, both from Jewish families. Both went to Harvard. Mike Abrams and Barry Green were two brilliant and ambitious Long Branch boys whose stories still meant something to Mr. Ash as he braced his feet against the sandy, shadeless, oil-stained dirt of his junkyard, and he pulled free the fuel pump for my coronet. He had his generation's respect for what performing well in school could do for somebody whose family had no money or power. So Mr. Ash told me about Mike and Barry. Mike Abrams went from Harvard College to graduate school, and he became a distinguished professor, the author of a famous book, The Mirror and the Lamp, a study of two romantic images for poetry. Although I had not exactly read the book, I had it on good authority that it was, as it did turn out to be, very good. The other Harvard boy in that same high school class, Barry Green, went on to become a rich lawyer, but sadly, as Mr. Ash told me the story he knew I knew, things took a bad turn for Barry Green. In the course of his climb to success, Barry got in deep with the mob, including a deal that involved selling orange peels to the government for the production of synthetic sugar. Like those leopard-spotted bathing suits of the Pallone boys and their beautiful mom, the orange peels were a familiar, legendary detail. The words synthetic sugar added the authority of specificity to our local tale of a deal saturated in fraud, bribery, chicanery, even, when you think about it, despoiling the United States Treasury in wartime. The dukes and generals of the mob, protecting the myth of their patriotism, declared that Barry Green would have to go to prison, and so he did. The unthinkable alternative was agreeing to testify with the likelihood of sudden disappearance. Barry's wife and his two daughters, attractive girls who took elocution lessons, the younger one the first girl in town to play Little League baseball, they were taken care of by those dukes and generals. Meanwhile, the story concluded, Mike Abrams continued the beautiful life of an honored professor at Cornell University, an Ivy League college in a class with Harvard itself, as Mr. Ash said, sighing emphatically. Mr. Ash knew from his daughter Phyllis, my classmate, that I had not been a good student in high school. Retelling the legend of Mike and Barry was his way of indicating respect for my apparent new seriousness. Wiping his head with his forearm, he finished with a moral, expressed by an example from our shared provincial landscape. Yes, Robert, there's two different paths in life. It's just like North Broadway and South Broadway. Broadway's two forks, North and South, form a Y just a couple of blocks from Long Branch's beachfront boardwalk. I nodded solemnly at Mr. Ashe's moral, his allegory of those two streets as two paths in life. At the same time, I was thinking that the two paths were pretty much identical. Mr. Ashe and I both knew quite well that North Broadway and South Broadway, not notably different from one another, extend to arrive, one long block apart, at exactly the same place, the Atlantic Ocean. Maybe the point of his story was the reality of shared knowledge, that he and I and the other people in our community all knew the same streets and the same stories. Maybe Mr. Ashe was thinking about my probably outliving him, and about my passage into a future as large and as mysterious as the ocean itself. California. Books. Poetry. He wanted to speak as the voice of the past, addressing the future. Chapter 2. Rockwell. In 1947, when I was 7 years old and my sister was two, my father got fired from the only job he had had since he was in high school. He and my mother were already painfully aware that many of their friends had bought suburban houses in Elberon or Oakhurst, while we were still crowding the four of us into a two-bedroom apartment at 36 Rockwell Avenue, near the corner of Monmouth Avenue. The people who lived on Monmouth Avenue, nearly all of them, were black. One exception was the apartment of my friends Jerry and Irwin Faber, halfway down Monmouth, next door to their father's junkyard. I. Faber Scrap Metal. Irwin was a year younger than me, Jerry a year older. A couple of my exact contemporaries at school, Billy Hanford and Lloyd Weaver, lived near the Fabers. I think one of them next door. Rockwell was all white people, mostly Italian and Jewish. The racial border, with its unspoken rules, seemed so unquestioned that I don't think white flight was much of an issue, or not yet. It was a poor neighborhood, and a segregated one, or you could call it two adjoining poor neighborhoods. In the summer, during the racing season, when the horses were running at Monmouth Park, some trainers and exercise boys rented rooms on Rockwell, so for a few weeks it felt more prosperous. The houses on Monmouth Avenue and Rockwell Avenue were converted multi-families, originally built as one-family places. I can identify the style now as the Craftsman period of the 1920s. When I read about the Craftsman style decades later, I remembered how in our apartment the plaster walls were not smooth, but crinkly, in an artistic random pattern. The irregular-shaped slates of the front walk were in that style of the same period. The paving was called crazy paving. Our walls and our front walk were inspired at many removes by the political and social writings of John Ruskin and William Morris. Their progressive ideas about art in the lives of ordinary people in the new industrial age of machine-made artifacts. On the corner of Rockwell and Monmouth, across the street from where we lived, was the office of Julius McKelvey, M.D., the neighborhood's black doctor. About the same time as I learned about Craftsman houses and William Morris, I discovered that Dr. McKelvey, from his borderland house and office at the corner of Rockwell and Monmouth, was active in the early years of the NAACP. Dr. McKelvey worked patiently, for years fruitlessly, to integrate the Long Branch beaches. Only one beach allowed black people access to the segregated Atlantic Ocean. I remember glimpses from across the street of Dr. McKelvey in his three-piece suit. At the other end of Monmouth Avenue, at the corner of Liberty Street, was the Tally Ho Tavern, where once, in a legendary bar fight, somebody bit off a policeman's finger. Next door to the Tally Ho on Liberty Street, a couple of my white friends, Andy Cullen and Martin Gates, lived with their mothers, who may have been sisters. Andy was blonde and sweet-natured. Martin was dark-haired, also a good friend, but not as open. Andy's father, he confided, was a soldier who died in an explosion when he was guarding an ammunition storehouse. Martin's stepfather was a Comanche Indian, a gloomy man I glimpsed once or twice where he was brooding in a shadowy bedroom. He once had studied to be a dentist, Martin told me. When I visited Long Branch High School, as a smiling 60-year-old public man, the words I could say that most impressed the assembled students were Rockwell Avenue, a rough hood to them, a slum, as my mother called it, in arguments that intensified after my father lost his job. Together, partly as a way to deny what seemed his failure in those years, Milford and Sylvia Pinsky took pride in their wit, their skill as dancers and at games, their good looks and their style. Politicians talk about family values. The Pinsky family valued our belief that we were better looking than other people, also funnier, and, with scant justification, that we had better taste, especially in clothes. Henry David Thoreau's dictum, "Beware of all enterprises that require new clothes," always makes me think, that's not how I was brought up. Wardrobe ranked above rehearsal. Sylvia dressed me, her firstborn, carefully. "I washed his white shoelaces," she used to say. Clothes, in a way, compensated for real estate. Ads for the ranch-style tract houses in Elbron, houses that we could not afford, celebrated their picture windows in the living room, wide, factory-sealed panes of glass, uninterrupted by movable sash. My mother mocked the pictures you could see from the picture windows of those identical houses. Mainly, the view was the house across the street. Some picture, some ranch. "Or maybe," she said, "it's all about the picture you can look at when you drive by. Ruthie Edelstein's ass, wide like the window." After my brother was born, there were three of us kids in the two-bedroom Rockwell Avenue apartment. Sylvia and Milford began searching more desperately for a post-war tract house that might be in their price range. Around that time, at the age of 10 or 11, I began to understand that our family's preening scorn was defensive. Also, in another sense, offensive. The outlaw swagger of my grandfather, Dave Pinsky, the barkeeper and former bootlegger, may have inspired that spurious glamour. I don't know how much my parents' pose of superiority to suburban homeowners was related in my mind later, as a newly literary college kid, to the superiority of James Joyce, Virginia Woolf, and Marcel Proust to Pearl Buck and her Nobel Prize, or to Herman Wouk and the movies based on his bestsellers. I was overeager to embrace kinds of judgment I had not done the work to earn. It would be many years before I could absorb the truth, harsh but liberating, that judgment in art depends on work, not hearsay. And it is never final. Willa Cather, in The Song of the Lark, tells the great truth about the serious artist who dies never being sure of their art's measure. When Cather celebrates the shards of clay vessels that once carried water for the makers who shaped them, fired them, and painted them. She conveys how the work itself is the reward and the punishment. My freshman year posing did not mean I was stupid or entirely a phony. I was callow, but I did know how to read with attention. I could recognize the Dublin of Joyce's Ulysses, with its bar talkers and local histories, the provincial web of backbiting, loyalty, and gossip. It was like Long Branch, and yet all of that soiled vitality Joyce created was also his reenactment of the Odyssey. The good singing voice and sharp tongue of Stephen Dedalus's father, Simon Dedalus, and the magnetism of sexy Molly Bloom. Performative local figures Dublin at large admired, yet frowned at. They stirred recognition in me. Characters respected for their gifts, but not entirely respectable, were a type I recognized. Even the wandering, inventive hero of the Odyssey was a bit of a bullshit artist. In a way, it was music that brought me to Ulysses. In my freshman year at Rutgers, the first-year course, Introduction to Literature, was required for two kinds of student, prospective majors in English and in physical education. Sections of the course were reserved for one category or the other. Because band rehearsals affected my schedule, I was assigned to a section where everybody else was planning to major in physical education. Their commitments to athletic practices and games corresponded to my rehearsal and practice times. I was in the jazz band, but more practically in the marching band, which released me from carrying a rifle in the Reserve Officers Training Corps. ROTC was required back then for the first 2 years at all American state universities. We were cannon fodder, or at least drill fodder, with our presence giving the real 4-year ROTC students lots of people in uniforms to receive their orders. While other freshmen carried rifles and learned the manual of arms, I carried my Butcher Aristocrat tenor saxophone. And while the others in my intro to lit class played sports, I played my part in the lower ranks of the reed section for big band arrangements of the Bartlesville Boogie or In the Mood. I don't mean to stereotype the athletes. Some of them were impressive writers and readers, but in that class, I shone, and I knew it. Worse, I was pretentious enough and naive enough to show that I knew it. The teacher, Maurice Charney, gave me extra assignments such as, for example, writing a parody of T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland in the style of Raymond Chandler. To take me gently down a notch, and maybe to amuse himself, Charney one day asked me, with a straight face, had I ever read Ulysses by James Joyce? I don't think so, sir. I had never heard of the author or the book, but I got a copy from the library. A lot of it confused me. On the first page, one character emerges from something called the stairhead to join others on a tower where somebody leans on a gun rest. Maybe they were soldiers at war? Somebody who talks a lot in those first pages is wearing something called a dressing gown while holding a shaving bowl. Those mysterious objects, like Joyce's cloud of literary references, bewildered me in an exciting way. But I loved Ulysses as a book about New Jersey. Years later, I recognized that feeling when I read an interview with Gabriel Garcia Marquez, where he says that the best South American novel ever written is The Hamlet by William Faulkner. As an ambitious, pseudo-intellectual freshman, I set out to understand what Joyce's autobiographical character, Stephen Dedalus, means by saying that history is a nightmare from which I am trying to awake. Those words of Joyce's priggish, arrogant young alter ego, became a
sample complete. Ready to continue?